Accession number 14620, Reel 5.
Major Smith, Reel 5. You were just saying at Spurn Point as well.
Yeah, Spurn Point was a bit of a problem because it was very exposed and occasionally the sea would wash over it and wash away the mines or whatever. So it was a continual problem, and we had all through 1949, 50, 51, probably right into sort of 55 and later, reports of mines appearing on beaches. Quite often beaches that had never had any mines on them. These are ones that had been carried down the coast from other places and redeposited on the beach. They posed a particular hazard, particularly for children. There were one or two tragic incidents where children had been killed as a result of these things. So we always responded very quickly to those, rushed out and dealt with it. The mine itself was a nasty one. It was designed as an anti-tank mine, but due to corrosion in the salty air, salty water, this bowspring, which was designed to operate under the weight of a vehicle, was quite often so rusted through that it would operate with quite a light pressure on it, a person standing on it or pressing on it, or even a fall of sand on the sand dunes, falling on it could set it off. They were rather nasty things. Our practice was, whenever possible, to blow it up where we found it. Don't mess about with it. Very occasionally we had to move them to a place of safety because of some hazard. It could be damaged if it did explode, but wherever possible we blew them up in situ.
About which years would you be doing all this?
This was down the Lincolnshire and Norfolk coast, places like Mablethorpe, Hingermells, Wells next to sea, Blakeney Point in Norfolk. That was an interesting one. A policeman reported a mine on a beach. It's a shingle back. We walked out, sure enough, it was a B-type C mine, one of these I was telling you about. Put a charge against it. The policeman assured me the beach had been cleared and been fenced off, nobody allowed along. We all retired to a safe distance, took cover, such as there was on the bare beach. Set off the charge, blew up the mine, large bang, cloud of smoke, shower of pebbles and so on. And just beyond where the mine was, this surprised figure rose up out of the beach, wondering what the hell had happened. Apparently this chap had been beach combing or something along the beach, and he'd been quite close. It taught me a lesson: never take anyone's word for it, always make sure yourself that there's no one there. Fortunately he wasn't hurt, but that was an object lesson on safety precautions.
Was that in the early 50s?
Yes, 51, something like that. Then we had one minefield that was still a live minefield, a place called Mundersley on the Norfolk coast, just south of Cromer. The cliffs at Mundersley are clay cliffs and they erode away, they say about 5 feet a year, but obviously that's an average. And because the cliff had eroded, the surface in which the mines had been laid had slid down, and then other bits of the cliff had sort of come over and covered them. So while some of the mines were almost visible, others were buried, maybe with tons and tons of earth. And the only way we could get them would be to wait for them to work their way out to the shore. And that was quite a problem. So this beach was fenced off, and I believe it's only recently been opened to the public. But what we used to do was patrol the beach and go along the edge of the cliff looking for any signs of these mines, and occasionally we would find one and blow it up. We did a deliberate operation on one occasion to with a drag line and try and scoop the earth off to expose the mines, and bomb disposal lost a couple of chaps killed as a result of that operation. Again, that was back in the 50s. Nasty things. Yeah, I think that's really all I can say about it.
So, can we say how you came to go to Korea now, please? I think it was December 52.
Well, I applied for a regular commission. See, previously I'd been on a, first of all, an emergency commission from the war. Then it was converted into a short service commission, and then to an extended short service commission. But then they reopened recruitment to a regular commission, which of course required certain standards of education and background. I applied, but I was having difficulty convincing them that I was a suitable candidate. First of all, they challenged my education qualifications, and I sorted them out on that. And then I went on another interview, and they said, well, of course, all your experience has been in bomb disposal, hasn't it? You've never had any field experience or experience in other units. So, rather cheekily, I said, no, whose fault's that? You haven't posted me to other than bomb disposal. If you want me to gain this experience, post me to a field unit. And that was probably noted. And they wanted officers for 28th Field Engineer Regiment out in Korea. So my name came up, posting to 28th Field Regiment in Korea. So I duly embarked at Liverpool and departed on the original slow boat to China. It took us about 30 odd days to get there. Exciting voyage in many ways. I always remember it. For the British Empire, we got down to Gibraltar. We stopped off Steamer Point at Gibraltar, off the Rock at Gibraltar. There was the Union Jack flying. I didn't see Malta because I was in the sick bay with my appendix out at the time. We got to Alexandria, but we'd fallen out with Colonel Nasser at the time, and we weren't allowed ashore. But then we sailed down through the canal, and of course the British troops were still in the canal zone, so there were Union Jacks flying there. And we got to Aden, anchored off Steamer Point, we're allowed ashore. There was a Union Jack flying there. Then we sailed across to Colombo and Ceylon, Union Jack flying there. And we got to Singapore, Union Jack flying there, band from the Gurkhas playing on the quayside. Great. And we went up to Hong Kong, Union Jack flying there. And we went up to Busan. Oh dear. There was an American Negro band playing on the quayside, and a delegation of South Korean government officials to welcome us. Well, they weren't welcoming me, they were welcoming 1st Royal Tank Regiment, who were aboard. They were going to replace whoever was there at the time, but it was a regimental replacement, and they were the main unit. And that was almost hilarious. It really was, the difference in approach to it shook me. I had never come across people before, you know, foreign governments, foreign armies and so on. It really shook me.
Why should it be so shaking, though?
Why should it be
so shaking?
It was so theatrical and so it was so unmilitary in my view. speeches in flowing terms about how we come to defend the freedom, and oh dear, it made you weep almost. Then I went to Japan, and we went to the reinforcement depot in Kure, and we were sorted out. Then they decided that they didn't really want me in Korea. They needed to ensure that regular officers had the postings so they could get combat experience, and we short service people had to take other jobs. So I ended up in a unit called Britcom Engineer Regiment, which was a hybrid unit, mainly Australian, with a British contingent and a Canadian contingent and the odd New Zealander. And they were in support of the British Commonwealth Forces Korea base in Kure. And I became Bomb Disposal Officer, British Commonwealth Forces Korea. Sounds wonderful. Now, I'd contacted my predecessor in this post, one Derek Dolby, and he'd given me a wonderful spiel about what a wonderful job it was and whatever. But I couldn't find anything to do. There were no bombs, no mines, nothing. So I went off to Korea to see the division. I got over there and said, you know, I'm supposed to be Bomb Disposal Officer. Have you got any bombs that want disposing of? No. So she better go and see the Americans. They do all that sort of stuff. So off I went down to Seoul and found the 24th EOD Control Detachment, commanded by one Ledley H. Ogden. And they were a small headquarter unit who controlled BD squads with each of the American divisions up in the line, and they would coordinate the operations of all these squads. They belonged to the American Army Ordnance Corps, so as well as dealing with enemy ordnance, they also dealt with their own ordnance. So if there was any defective ammunition or anything involving the safe handling or storage, they would be expected to advise and deal with it. It wasn't just a sort of bomb disposal setup, rather like our Army Ordnance Corps used to do, now the Royal Logistics Corps, of course. But they were very good. They got me involved, told me what was going on. Showed me samples of what they'd recovered, and let me go out with them on some of their jobs, some of their operations. And I found an old file here which mentions some of the things that we dealt with. Peculiar Russian bombs, Chinese bombs, and all sorts of funny munitions, some of them homemade.
Why were the Russian bombs so funny?
They were rather crude, roughly made. They didn't incorporate any of the safety devices which Allied ammunition incorporates, you know, making it safe for our own people to handle, for example. Anyway, I collected a number of samples of Russian bomb fuses, and I shoved them in a box, packed them carefully in a box, took them back to Japan with me, and I set to check them over and pack them carefully to send them back to Britain for our own research people to look at them and analyse them and evaluate them. And when I was working on one of the fuses, I noticed that it still had its detonator on it, which illustrates just how careless the Americans can be when I think that I carry this blessed thing all the way from Korea on an aircraft, Royal Australian Air Force. Makes you shudder when you think about it. Anyway, whilst I was handing this damn thing, the detonator exploded. My hand, I had it in my hand. Exploded. Blew the end of my fingers off. Peppered my face. Whatever. That's how I hurt myself. Whether it was the heat of my hand, whether the thing had been lying around in the field, hot and cold in Korea, whether I'd squeezed it or knocked it, I don't know. All I know is it went off in my hand. And I ended up in hospital.
A US Army hospital?
British Commonwealth Hospital in Curie. Looked after by the QAs. And they did a marvellous job on me. Pretty marvellous, they really were. They sewed my hands up. Colonel Wright, who was the surgeon, did a good job. Skin grafts on my fingers. My eyes were treated by a chap called Ken Milne, who was the ophthalmist. And he took fragments of the detonator out of my eye and sewed up my eyeball. You think about it. He put 3 stitches in my eyeball. Can you imagine it? Brilliant. I mean, you hear today about marvels of surgery. And there he was in a base hospital out in Japan. And he did that. Incredible chap.
Did you have a general anaesthetic?
Oh yeah, I was out for 3 days. Didn't know what was happening for 3 days. Anyway, when I came round, I couldn't see anything. My eyes were swathed in bandages, my hands were swathed, so I couldn't see and I couldn't feel. I had to be fed by a nurse, an Australian nurse actually, and I used to talk to her. I never saw her, but I used to chat to her. She came from a sheep farm in Victoria. She would tell me how she would go rounding up the sheep on a motorbike. Incredible. Nice girl. Often wonder what happened to her. Anyway, about a week, 10 days later, they decided they'd take the bandages off and have a look at me. And they decided, possibly. So they whizzed me down to the theatre and took the stitches out of my eye. And then about another 3 days later, took the bandages off again. And I said, oh, I can see. First of all, the lighted window on the other side of the ward appeared. And then the QA's red cape came into view. And then the white thing of the QA
headdress
appeared, and slowly I could discern her face. Great. Mary MacDonald, they called that sister, I remember her. Anyway, called the doctor, Milne came up, and he looked at me and peered into my eyes. Yes, good, right, fine. That was all he said. Slapped the bandages back on and said, give it a few more days. Then they took them off again, and one eye was all right. Could see quite normally out of that. The other one still had a patch on, so I had quite a piratical air going around with a black patch on my eye and the gloves on my hand to hide the rather horrible mess these were in. I was in hospital. probably a fortnight, 3 weeks, something like that. Then I recovered sufficiently to go to the rehabilitation rest place on Miyajima Island in Hiroshima Bay. And they had lots of recreational facilities, including some yachts, little sailing dinghies. So I thought, oh, I'll take one of these out. So I went sailing, which was quite nice. And then a storm blew up, strong wind, and I found I couldn't beat back against the wind back to the jetty. And I got carried down the inland sea in the Hiroshima Bay. Anyway, a Japanese fisherman could see I was struggling, and he came alongside and slung me a line and towed me back. By this time it was dark and there were bloody search parties out, hell on. And anyway, I got back to the rehab place. My hands, what I'd done with the salt water and handling the sheets, it had stripped the ruddy skin grafts off my hands, opened the wounds again. So I got sent back to Curie, to the hospital. Of course, when the surgeon saw it, how did this happen? So I was in dead trouble after that. I wasn't allowed any more. So as soon as I got better, I was sent straight back to my unit. Served me right. Then I resumed duty. I went up to see the US Navy up in Yokosuka, up near Yokohama. Again, they were mainly dealing with their own ammunition problems. Gave me a chance to meet people and to see their techniques and whatever, but it wasn't really bomb disposal. I went across to Korea again and saw the Americans. Went and visited a few of the divisions up on the line, places like Pork Chop and whatever, you know, the famous places. But the war was reached a stalemate by then. There wasn't a lot going on, and what did go on were mainly at night skirmishes and patrolling and whatever, so I didn't see much action at all. And while I was up there, I took the opportunity to call in on 28 Div, because while I was in Korea, I also acted as a liaison between Britcom Engineer Regiment and the people in the division. So while I was there, I saw the chief engineer and said, look, what's the chance of me coming to 28th Regiment the way I was supposed to, and explain why and whatever. So he said, well, see if we can find you a vacancy. And that was where we left it. Anyway, I went back to Japan. Shortly afterwards, I got a phone call from him saying that he had a post he could put me in as a liaison officer in the divisional headquarters, in G branch of Div headquarters. So I thought, great, fine, that'll at least get some sharp end experience. And I duly became an LO, liaison officer, with the G branch in 28th Division. Sorry, in HQ Commonwealth Div. This involved visiting the sharp end, visiting the brigades and battalions, attending briefings, giving briefings. Every morning the general would have a sort of old group when all the intelligence and operations over the previous 24 hours were reviewed, discussed, and the general gave his orders for the day. So I learned quite a lot. Then the war ended. And the next step was the agreement to pull back 1 kilometre from the line. And the 2 kilometre space between the opposing armies would be a demilitarised zone. And there was a time limit on how long we had to demilitarise, after which it would be excluded. You know, no one was allowed in without permission, sort of thing. One of the first requirements was to mark the actual line. And to do this, there was an armistice commission set up, consisting of neutral powers, Swedes, some South Americans, people who weren't involved on either side, can't remember exactly who they were, some odd characters. And I was, as a liaison officer, was attached to one of these armistice commission groups to go with them, you know, to liaise with them, make sure they got from A to B, and to, you know, see they were all right. And I remember going with them, and we were going along this line. We had a party of sappers with us, and the idea was that they would decide where the line was, and they would drive stakes into the ground and fix white tape to it. This was the first demarcation line. As we came along, we came to a minefield, and a great discussion then took place what we're going to do. So I said, you know, go around this way. In other words, conceding the minefield to the enemy, as it were. You can have that bit of territory. But one of the senior, I think it was a Swede, said, no, the plan says through there, we will go through there. So I said, righto. Got on the radio, called up the sappers, and they produced a team and pulled everybody back and swept away through the minefield. Anyway, shortly afterwards, back in the mess, this colonel of the Swedish army took me aside, and he said, you know, sorry I was a bit sort of sharp with you, but this plan is what was agreed at Panmunjom. If we deviate from it by 1 millimetre, it could lead to an incident in the future. So it's got to be exactly as per plan. And on reflection, of course, he's dead right, I suppose. I didn't think much of the idea at the time, risking our troops going through this bloody awful minefield, risking their lives just to provide a demarcation line.